sleeping men with weapons carelessly scattered around could well tempt a roving band of Indians into an attack. A well-regulated camp, with guards posted and calling out challenges, would not. Instead of a fight, there would be a talk, which was what Lewis wanted most of all, because he believed the United States could bring more and better trade goods to the Missouri country from St. Louis than the British could bring down from Canada. Given a chance, Americans would win the fur trade. To prevent surprise, Lewis's detachment orders of May 26th stressed alertness. The sergeant of the guard had as part of his duty posting sentinels and ensuring the security of the camp. These were clear, direct orders with no words wasted but all possibilities covered, and they signified that the expedition was now in a war zone and might be attacked at any time. To add to nighttime security, the expedition camped on islands whenever feasible. There were daily inspections of the rifles, the blunderbusses, and the cannon to be certain they were ready for action. Lewis's May 26th order provides a series of images of life on the keelboat. He divided the permanent party into three squads or messes, which, among other things, would cook and eat together. Each evening, upon landing, Sergeant Ordway would hand out to each mess a day's provisions. It would be cooked at once and a portion reserved for the following day. No cooking was allowed during the day. The regular ration was hominy and lard on one day, salt pork and flour the next, and cornmeal and pork the following day. Eating hominy and lard cold on the day after it was cooked must have made fresh meat welcome. To provide it, Driard and two or three companions and two horses acquired in St. Charles went out every day to hunt. When they brought in deer or bear, no lard or pork was to be issued. From the third day of the expedition on, Lewis was conserving rations. Lewis's detachment order was exact about the responsibilities of the sergeants on the boat as it moved upstream. One sergeant was stationed at the helm, another midships, and the third in the bow. The sergeant at the helm steered, saw to the baggage on the quarterdeck, and attended the compass. The sergeant midships commanded the guard, managed the sails, saw that the men at the oars did their duty, and kept a good lookout for the mouths of all rivers, creeks, islands, and other remarkable places. He also measured out the whiskey ration and served as the sergeant of the guard at night. The sergeant at the bow was charged to keep a good lookout and to report all pirogues or other craft in the river and all hunting camps or parties of Indians. Two of the privates had specified duty. They were Labiche and Cruzat, the mixed bloods who had joined up in St. Charles. They had been up the Missouri before and were the best rivermen in the enlisted ranks. Lewis ordered that they man the larboard bow oar alternately, and the one not engaged at the oar will attend as the bowsman, and when the attention of both these persons is necessary at the bow, their oar is to be manned by any idle hand on board. The bowman's tasks included warding off floating debris with his iron-tipped pole, calling out warnings of dangers ahead, looking for the best place to cross the river, and watching for sandbars, whirlpools, whatever. On June 8th, the bowman called out, "Pirogue ahead!" The boats tied up at a bank, and the two parties began to exchange information. The three downstream travelers explained that they had been hunting and trapping on the upper Missouri for the past year. Clark estimated that they had about $900 worth of pelts and furs. This was big money in the pre-Industrial Revolution age, about as profitable a venture as any young, ambitious entrepreneur could find, other than a gold or silver claim. Of course, as always, the men who did the hard part and took the greatest risks got the least reward. The $900 the voyagers got in St. Louis would grow by a factor of 10 by the time the furs reached New York. In China, they were worth 10 times the New York price. From the Indian point of view, the furs were their resources, taken without their permission and without payment. One had to doubt that they would continue to allow white men to trap their creeks and rivers. Even if they did, without trading posts scattered along the Missouri, small parties could hardly hope to be successful. The three men the expedition met on June 8th were out of provisions and powder. Even with a handout from the captains, they were just going to make it back to St. Louis. On June 12th, the bowman again cried out, "Pirogues ahead!" This time, there were two pirogues. One contained furs, the other buffalo grease and tallow. Lewis bought 300 pounds of voyager's grease from the trappers, whether for food or insect repellent or both is unclear. he paid with a chit that could be cashed with Stoddard in St. Louis. The leader of the party was Pierre Dorion, Sr., a 55-year-old Frenchman who had known George Rogers Clark back in Illinois during the Revolutionary War. In 1785, Dorion had settled down with the Yankton Sioux on the Missouri above the Platte. He had a Yankton wife and spoke the language fluently, as well as French and English. Such priceless skills could not be ignored. Lewis and Clark persuaded Dorion, old Dorion in Clark's journal, to return to the Sioux villages with them. They hoped that Dorion could persuade some Sioux chiefs to go to Washington to meet their new father. On June 17th, Clark complained, "The party is much afflicted with boils, and several have the dysentery, which I contribute to the water, which is muddy." The next day, several men had the dysentery, and 2/3 of them with ulcers or boils, some with 8 or 10 of those tumors. Lewis agreed with Clark's diagnosis that the water was to blame. The captains urged the men to dip their cups below the surface when they went for a drink of water. The surface water was full of scum, mud, and debris. If the men dipped deep, they could get cleaner water. The captains were undoubtedly right about the bad effects of the water, but an equal culprit in bringing on the boils and other skin problems was their diet. Only on the rarest of occasions did the party get fresh vegetables, such as watercress, and there was no ripe fruit as yet. Roman legions put vinegar in their drinking water, but Lewis and Clark had taken no such precaution. They and their men were living on meat and cornmeal. The meat was contaminated with bacteria, of whose existence they were unaware. Infected mosquito bites also contributed to their ailments. In camp, ticks and gnats were bad, mosquitoes a plague. They came up in droves, so thick that the men could not keep them out of their eyes, noses, ears, and throats. To escape, men stood in the smoke of the fire and coated their exposed limbs, neck, and face with voyager's grease. On June 26th, the expedition completed its westward trek of nearly 400 river miles across the present state of Missouri and arrived at the mouth of the Kansas River. There, they spent nearly 4 days making observations and airing, sunning, and repacking their goods. "The country about the mouth of this river is very fine," Clark wrote about the site of present-day Kansas City. He measured the width of the rivers. The Kansas was 230 yards wide, the Missouri 500. Lewis weighed the water of the two rivers and found the Missouri's to be heavier, meaning it carried more mud. Still, Clark found, "The waters of the Kansas is very disagreeably tasted to me." On the evening of June 28th, the party made ready to push back into the river at dawn. But that night, there was a raid on the whiskey supply, serious enough to cause a delay. Alcohol in any form has always been a curse and a necessity to military leaders. Drunkenness causes more discipline and personnel problems than any other cause, but soldiers must have their alcohol. Frederick the Great put it best. "If you contemplate some enterprise against the enemy, the commissary must scrape together all of the beer and brandy that can be found so that the army does not lack either, at least during the first few days." In other words, don't run out of booze until there is no turning back. Lewis had bought all the whiskey he felt could be carried without making an unacceptable sacrifice somewhere else, for example, in trade goods. The total figure is disputed, but about 120 gallons is generally accepted. The daily ration was 1 gill. Used at that rate, the whiskey would be gone in 104 days. That could be stretched by watering down the whiskey, but it was still obvious that there was not enough to make it to the Pacific and back. No doubt every man in the party knew exactly how much whiskey was available and how much of it was his by rights. They knew they would run out. It had happened to them before. They could handle it as long as everyone ran out at the same time and no man got a half ounce more than his fair share. Just after midnight, June 28th to 29th, Private John Collins was on guard duty. He tapped a barrel. "Just one little sip wouldn't hurt. Just one more. Another." Soon he was drunk. Private Hugh Hall came up. Collins offered him a drink. Hall accepted. Soon they were drunk together. At dawn, the sergeant of the guard put them under arrest, and shortly thereafter, Clark began drawing up court-martial papers. While Clark prepared for the trial, Lewis took advantage of a clear sky and a morning moon. He measured the distance between the sun and the moon's nearest limb 48 times between 7:06 and 8:57 a.m. He faithfully recorded whatever he could, whenever he could, leaving up to experts back east to work out the meaning of the figures. At 11 o'clock a.m., the court convened, agreeable to order. Sergeant Pryor presided, Private John Potts acted as judge advocate, and four privates were members. Sergeant Ordway charged Collins with getting drunk on his post this morning out of whiskey put under his charge as a sentinel, and for suffering Hugh Hall to draw whiskey out of the said barrel intended for the party. Collins pled, not guilty. The court deliberated, then concluded, guilty, and sentenced Collins to 100 lashes on his bare back. Hall was charged with taking whiskey out of a keg this morning, which was contrary to all order, rule, or regulation. Having seen what happened to Collins, Hall tried a bit of plea bargaining. Guilty! He was sentenced to receive 50 lashes well laid on. Lewis and Clark approved the sentence and ordered it carried out at 3:30 p.m. It was, with vigor. Clark noted that, "We have always found the men very ready to punish such crimes." Flogging was cruel, but not unusual. Slaveholders had seen it all their lives. Officers in the army saw it done on a regular basis to their own men. In this case, it fit the need perfectly. It allowed the men to let out their anger in a direct, physical way. It caused Collins and Hall great pain. But the expedition didn't lose their services. Both men were at the oars, groaning but at the oars, that afternoon. After a couple of sleepless nights of tossing and turning, they would be all right. Besides, there was no guardhouse on the boat to lock them up in. Deer to be seen in every direction, and their tracks are as plenty as hogs about a farm, Clark wrote on June 30th. Now headed north, the expedition was entering a near paradise. Clark noted, raspberries purple, ripe, and abundant. On July 4th, the men ushered in the day with the firing of the cannon. Private Joseph Field got bitten by a snake. Captain Lewis treated him with a poultice, probably of Peruvian bark, that drew the poison. At noon, the party pulled ashore at the mouth of a creek of some 15 yards wide, coming out of an extensive prairie on the left's west side. As they ate, the captains questioned the voyagers. No, they knew no name for the creek. The captains thereupon named it, their second experience in bestowing a name. They called it Independence Creek. Most of the rivers had French names. The first named by Clark was Cupboard Creek on June 3, 1804. The expedition pulled over for the night at the site of an old Kansas Indian town. We camped in the plain, Clark wrote, one of the most beautiful plains I ever saw, open and beautifully diversified with hills and valleys, all presenting themselves to the river covered with grass and a few scattering trees, a handsome creek meandering through. The captains ordered an extra gill distributed. As they sipped their portions, they took in their surroundings and were quite overwhelmed. The country was covered with a sweet and nourishing grass, interspersed with copses of trees, spreading their lofty branches over pools, springs, or brooks of fine water. Groups of shrubs covered with the most delicious fruit is to be seen in every direction, and nature appears to have exerted herself to beautify the scenery by the variety of flowers delicately and highly flavored, raised above the grass, which strikes and perfumes the sensation and amuses the mind. At sunset, the men again fired the cannon. It was the first ever 4th of July celebration west of the Mississippi River. Perhaps the captains grew philosophical under the influence of the whiskey, as happens to earnest young men carrying heavy responsibilities who find themselves in the Garden of Eden, as full dark comes on and the campfire burns down, on their nation's birthday. Clark's last journal entry that day. So magnificent a scenery, here follow several words that Clark later crossed out, in a country thus situated, far removed from the civilized world, to be enjoyed by nothing but the buffalo, elk, deer, and bear in which it abounds, and savage Indians. Possibly the captains puzzled over why God had created such a place and failed to put Virginians in it, or put it in Virginia. On July 8th, there was an Indian scare, a fire on the East Bank. All hands went on alert, but nothing came of it. On the night of July 11th to 12th, Private Alexander Willard went to sleep on his post. Ordway found him and turned him in. The offense was one of the most serious possible, punishable by death according to the regulations. The captains themselves constituted the court, rather than privates as in Collins's case. Ordway charged Willard with lying down and sleeping on his post whilst a sentinel. Willard pled guilty of lie down and not guilty of going to sleep. The captains conferred. After considering the evidence, they found Willard guilty on both counts. They sentenced him to 100 lashes each day for 4 days, beginning that evening at sunset. One shudders at the thought of Willard's back after the 4th day. One shudders at the thought of what might have happened had a roving band of Sioux come up while Willard was sleeping on guard duty. On July 21st, some 600 miles and 68 days upstream from Wood River, the expedition reached the mouth of the Platte River. This was a milestone. To go past the mouth of the Platte was the Missouri Riverman's equivalent of crossing the equator. It also meant entering a new ecosystem and Sioux territory. The expedition stopped so the captains could make the usual measurements. Lewis wrote a 500-word description of the Platte, that fabulous river that makes its way from the Rockies across modern Nebraska to the Missouri, running a mile wide and an inch deep, just bursting with animal and plant life. What most impressed Lewis was the immense quantity of sand the Platte emptied into the Missouri and the velocity of the current. He measured, as he always did. Whereas on the Mississippi, below St. Louis, a vessel would float at 4 miles an hour, and on the Missouri from 5.5 to 7, depending, on the Platte that vessel would make at least 8 miles an hour, assuming it never ran aground, which it would at every bend or sandbar. Lewis also made his celestial observations. The next morning he wrote a 1,000-word description of the instruments he was using, how he was using them, what he was measuring, and so forth. It seems Lewis wanted to be as sure as he could that someone someday would take all his figures and make some sense out of them. On July 30th, Clark recorded, "Captain Lewis and myself walked in the prairie on the top of the bluff and observed the most beautiful prospects imaginable. This prairie is covered with grass about 10 or 12 inch high. There were swans in a nearby pond. Great quantities of catfish were caught that evening." Private Joseph Field killed and brought in to Lewis a badger. Lewis wrote that, "This is a singular animal not common to any part of the United States," and went on with a description of its weight, teeth, eyes, and so on. Then he skinned and stuffed the badger to send back to Jefferson. This was the first time he had put into practice the taxidermic skills Jefferson had taught him. The badger was not new to science. A specimen sent from Canada to Europe in 1778 had been technically described. The expedition had already discovered, and Lewis had described, two animals new to science, the eastern wood rat and the plains horned toad. So far, 640 miles up the river, the party had not seen an Indian. All the river tribes were out on the prairie hunting buffalo. Chapter 13. Entering Indian Country. August 1804. August 1st was Clark's 34th birthday. To mark the occasion, I ordered a saddle of fat venison, an elk fleece, and a beaver tail to be cooked, and a dessert of cherries, plums, raspberries, currants, and grapes of a superior quality. Taking note of the flora and fauna in this wonderland the expedition was entering, Clark noted, "What a field for a botanist and a naturalist." No American, not even the professional naturalists, such as John James Audubon and Alexander Wilson, had ever seen anything to surpass it. Lewis was fully aware of the magnitude of the discoveries, and greatly excited by the opportunity to be the one to note and describe plants and animals new to science. He spent hours examining and describing his finds. On August 5th, for example, he killed a bull snake. He measured its length from nose to tail, 5 feet 2 inches, its circumference, 4.5 inches, the number of scuta on its belly, 221, and tail, 53, its color, spots, and other distinctive markings. That afternoon, he killed 2 aquatic birds he had previously observed but been unable to obtain. They were leased terns. He used 1,000 words to describe the specimens, including weight, 1.5 ounces, length, 7.5 inches, markings, and so on. He recorded, "The tail has 11 feathers, the outer of which are 1 inch longer than those in the center, gradually tapering inwards. The largest or outer feather is 2.75 inches, that of the shortest 1.75 inches. This bird is very noisy when flying, which it does extremely swift. It has 2 notes, one like the squawking of a small pig, only on rather a high key, the other kit-ti, kit-ti, as near as letters can express the sound." As the men laboriously moved the keelboat upriver, Lewis, in the cabin, weighed and measured and examined and recorded. He took his responsibilities seriously, but he had a lot of fun doing it, and he had a never-flagging sense of wonder and delight at seeing something new. On August 8th, one of the bowmen called back to Lewis, who was working in the cabin. The captain looked up to see a blanket of white coming down the river. He went to the bow to stare down into the water. The keelboat and the white whatever it was came together. On close examination, it turned out to be a sea of white feathers, over 3 miles long and 70 yards wide. The boat rounded a bend. Ahead was a large sandbar at the foot of a small island. It was entirely covered with white pelicans, preening themselves in their summer molt.